From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with film director John Schlesinger about his movies Midnight Cowboy, Marathon Man, Sunday Bloody Sunday, and The Falcon and the Snowman. And we preview his new movie, Madame Szaszka, starring Shirley MacLaine as a tyrannical piano teacher. Also, we talk with the world's best-known baby expert, Dr. Benjamin Spock, about his own upbringing. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new albums by flutist James Galway, and Ken Tucker reviews the new home video release of Quartet. It's the film adaptation of four William Somerset Maugham stories. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. British film director John Schlesinger made his first American movie in 1969 and walked off with Academy Awards for Best Director and Best Film. The film was Midnight Cowboy, starring Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. Since that film's success, Schlesinger has divided his time between England and the U.S. He's been making movies since 1961. His films include Billy Liar, Darling, Sunday Bloody Sunday, Marathon Man, The Falcon and the Snowman, and The Believers. Schlesinger first learned about movie making by acting and making documentaries for British television. His new film, Madame Szaszka, opens October 14th. It stars Shirley MacLaine as a Russian-American piano teacher living in London. Szaszka takes on young students with the potential for greatness and teaches them about life as well as music. She's demanding, temperamental, and jealous of other influences on her students, but under her guidance, several of her students have become brilliant pianists. Her new student is a 15-year-old boy of Indian heritage. In this scene, Madame Szaszka, played by Shirley MacLaine, meets with the boy's mother, played by Shabana Azmi, one of India's leading actresses.
No. I can take your son on Tuesdays and Thursdays. No, Tuesdays and Fridays.
Oh, but he helps me on Fridays. It's a very busy day for me with the weekend orders.
Mrs. Sen, whenever I take on a new student, I give myself and my time totally and freely. It is an absolute commitment for both of us, the student and myself, because, you see, I teach not only how to play the piano, but how to live. You'll be very proud of your son. Now there are two of us to care.
John Schlesinger, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've always said that you're more interested in themes relating to failure than success, and I wonder how that applies to your new film, Madame Szaszka.
Well, I think actually it's about people that have to deal with both the problems of being successful and the problems of having been a failure, which we all, every artist, I think, suffers or has to endure during his lifetime. And how do you deal with both and keep going and surmount all obstacles, I think, is one of the themes of this film, and certainly one of the important things of one's life.
I guess it's something you've had to deal with
absolutely.
Your film, success and failure.
Absolutely. All my life.
This is the first film role Shirley MacLaine has taken since Terms of Endearment, and I was wondering how you cast her in it.
Well, I'd admired her very much over the years, but particularly in Terms of Endearment, where I thought she'd shown extraordinary kind of courage in playing that role and appearing in all kinds of ages and conditions. And I needed a very courageous actress. Originally, we weren't looking for an American. It was written for a Russian, for a European, certainly. And when we decided to ask Shirley, who was my first choice in the States, I, for some reason, hadn't expected her to be as enthusiastic about the role in the film as she was. But she made an instant kind of identification with the part and excitement for the film and made a commitment which has been quite wonderful.
Shirley MacLaine and the young Indian actor who plays her student are both not musicians. What is it like to work with actors who aren't musicians but are playing pianists?
Make sure you've got a very good musician who understands the problems of an actor having to play a musician who is quite brilliant. I mean, Shirley, after all, is musical. I mean, she's been brought up in the musical theatre and she was a dancer. So Her background is certainly a musical one, and she understood all that and has indeed played a bit of piano in her time. Naveen Chowdhury, who plays opposite her as Manik in the film, the young, brilliant 15-year-old student of the piano, had never played a note of music in his life. I think he plays drums.
It must have been fun to hear this actor play when he was just hitting any note, but making it look
we,
right.
We've silenced the piano as quickly as we could, because really did sound awful. So from the very word go, he was always playing to playback or to a disc of some kind.
My guest is film director John Schlesinger, and his new film, Madame Szaszka, opens October 14th. I want to get back to this idea that you've, in many of your films, been more interested in failure than success. You know, when Rocky came along, Hollywood, anyways, got very success-oriented in its movies. Was that a bad turn for you?
No, because when you use failure rather too heavily, I think. I mean, in a sense, Midnight Cowboy was about two failures, but they won, in a sense, at the end, because they'd learned something through their relationship and so forth. And even though he was dying, Ratsarito did make it to Miami and died there. So in my view, that's not total failure. I think what I mean by being more interested in failure is trying to cope with it, in making the necessary compromises to that. If it was about success only, that would be too obvious for my taste. I mean, I think that it's the negative things that one has to deal with in life, make compromises over, make adjustments to, win against, that really interests me. It's the problems that failure throws up, I suppose.
I'd like to talk with you about some of your best-known films, and since we've already brought up Midnight Cowboy, why don't we start with that? This was the first film that you made in the United States.
Yes.
And John Voight stars as someone from the South, right? I forget if it's from
Texas.
The South or the Midwest. From Texas,
Texas,
yeah. Who moves to New York, and he thinks he's going to become this great stud, but instead of hustling other people, everybody else basically hustles him. And one of the people who he meets is Ratso Rizzo, played by Dustin Hoffman. And I'd like to play the bar scene in which these two characters meet. And the part of the scene that we're playing opens with John Voight being kind of propositioned by a transvestite.
Hi, cowboy. Got a cigarette?
Hey, sweetheart.
More damn faggots in this town.
Oh, kiss it, Ratso.
Up yours. You gotta watch out for that.
Hey, you really know the ropes.
Oh, damn, I wish I bumped into you before.
Huh.
I'm Joe Buck from Texas.
Enrico Rizzo from the Bronx.
And I'm gonna buy you a drink. What the hell do you think of that?
Well, I don't mind if I do.
Bartender, drinks all around. One for my friend here, too.
Damn, I know when I give satisfaction, I give her satisfaction. I mean, you see what I'm getting at here? She got a penthouse up there with a color TV, more diamonds than the Archbishop. And she busts out bawling when I ask her for money.
For what?
For money.
Wait a minute. For money for what?
Oh, hell, I'm a hustler. You didn't know that?
Now, how am I supposed to know that? I mean, you got to tell a person these things.
I'm a hustler.
It's a scene from Midnight Cowboy. Now, this is the story of someone who comes from Texas to New York and really doesn't know his way around and makes a lot of mistakes while learning the ropes. This was your first film in America. Did you empathize at all, since you were new to the country yourself?
Totally. I mean, that was the reason I thought I could make the film, because in a sense, New York is a fantasy for the cowboy. And he thinks, he imagines it as one thing, and then the reality turns out to be something quite different. And I suppose in a way I could sympathise and empathise with that. And most of the films that I've made in the States have in some way been about fantasy or fantasists. And I felt that that was something I really could relate to.
You worked with Dustin Hoffman in this film before he really became a star. I think you actually cast him before The Graduate came out.
No, The Graduate was already out, and I didn't believe that he was a character actor until I actually met him, dressed for the role. He came to meet me in New York, and we walked around 42nd Street, and he was wearing a dirty old raincoat, and kind of melded in so perfectly with the background that he got the part by the end of the evening. And all I'd got to go on was the reputation as a character actor and having seen him in The Graduate playing a very different kind of role.
When he was walking around in that raincoat, was that something he was doing to prove to you how good a character actor he could be, or is that just the way he was dressed?
No, he was trying to prove.
Oh, okay,
he was trying to
checking.
Get the part, I reckon, yes.
I think when this movie came out, it was X-rated.
Yes.
Initially?
Yes, it was.
It seems pretty tame by today's standards. I mean, there's four-letter words in it and some nudity, but it's still... You think it would have gotten an X today?
No. It very quickly lost its X, in fact.
Oh.
After the Oscars.
Did you fight for that, or did you just...
No, at the time, I think Jerry Hellman, the producer, and I both felt, you know, okay, that's probably what it should get. It was the X rating then meant something quite different to the rating now. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it got an R rating, they'd already changed the meanings of what X rating represented.
Midnight Cowboy was your first film in the United States. Why did you want to make an American film?
Oh, I thought the book was extraordinary, and it would give me an opportunity to deal with an American theme. I hadn't. Until I read the book, I'd had no ambition actually to come here to work. And when I read it, I thought, this is a hell of a story, and I understand these two characters, even though I don't know them, really. And I came to America on the heels of a tremendous failure, Far From the Madding Crowd, which was a quite tough baptism of fire. And I stayed on in Los Angeles after it had opened there and flopped rather badly, working on the screenplay of Midnight Cowboy with Waldo Salt, and hung around, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, which is a fairly sleazy area, and some of the things in the film I saw and experienced on the boulevard, and then came to New York, and with Waldo we trudged the streets of New York experiencing more things, all of which have a place in the movie. And it was a very interesting period of my life because I came to the States to promote a film which hadn't worked. So I knew what rejection in Hollywood terms meant and how. And then started to work on this next movie and really got more and more hooked and intrigued by the whole subject.
Well, Midnight Cowboy was made in 1969. Let me ask you about a film you made a couple of years later in England, Sunday Bloody Sunday.
And yes.
This film starred Glenda Jackson and Peter Finch as two people both in love with the same man, a bisexual man. Was it hard to get backing to do this movie? It was not a moralistic film that preached against homosexuality.
No, it certainly wasn't. No, it was, and funnily enough, though the subject was tough, I suppose, the fact that Midnight Cowboy was so successful enabled me to get backing fairly quickly from United Artists, who'd also distributed Midnight Cowboy. And I remember the remark of David Picker, who was running the company, head of production at that time, I don't quite know where this script is taking us, but if you want to do it. It's not going to cost too much. And we did.
There's a scene where Peter Finch and Murray Head, the actor who plays the bisexual man, kiss. And it was really a very brave scene for the time, for 1971.
Yes, that was ahead of its time.
Did you have to fight to include that?
No, I didn't have to fight to include it. I mean, some very strange things happened. I mean, the actors didn't object to doing it because they realised that it was quite important. And I felt it had to be treated just as an everyday occurrence. I mean, Penelope Gilliard, who wrote the screenplay, and I had some quite serious arguments about the scene because she felt it should be kind of done in long shot and silhouette and in a sense made a special deal of by trying to throw it away. And I felt it should just happen in front of the camera with no big deal as part of their everyday behaviour in private. And that's the way we did it. And there were objections, certainly, in the cinema. I remember one of the first screenings in America, a woman nudged her husband in front of me and said, "Come on, Harry, let's get out. This is not a film for nice people." And Peter Finch's wife could never quite get used to it when she came to the opening and at Venice Festival. I remember she screamed out loud when the kiss happened. And I said before the London premiere, now, please just keep your trap shut. You know it's coming. Shut up. But she couldn't resist screaming again. So I was very glad she wasn't on the road with us in America.
It's really funny. She'd probably seen her husband getting killed in movies.
Yes, but the idea...
get this kind of reaction.
No, this was more horrendous to her, I guess. Anyway, it was a film that I think was probably ahead of its time, and I don't think that the United Artists expected it to have the kind of critical success it did, and I'm very glad that it got the attention it did. And by some strange trick of fate now in London, in England, there's a new law, Clause 28, which has just been passed, which forbids any local authority to back anything that encourages or is seen to promote the cause of homosexuality.
So are you saying that you think you wouldn't have been able to make that scene?
No, now I'm saying this film, mm-hmm. 20 years after the event, could not be included in any kind of special festival of films financed by a local government body, as it would be seen to promote the cause of homosexuality, thus putting us back over 20 years in censorship. It's quite ludicrous, and we're all fighting it.
How are you fighting it?
By a great deal of protest. It is law now, and they say it's not intended to, you know, ban the works of Oscar Wilde in the local public library or so on and so forth. But I think that it could play into the hands of the really bigoted, of which there are plenty about.
It must be very disturbing to feel that things are going backwards.
Yes, very, indeed. I think it's a state of affairs which has been brought on by a number of things, including the paranoia and the lack of understanding and the fear of AIDS, I guess.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is British film director John Schlesinger, and his films include Sunday Bloody Sunday, Midnight Cowboy, Marathon Man, and The Falcon and the Snowman. His new film, Madame Suzatska, stars Shirley MacLaine, and it opens on October 14th. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director John Schlesinger is my guest, and his film Madame Suzatska opens October 14th. Let me ask you about the film Marathon Man. You made this in 1976. It also starred Dustin Hoffman. As a graduate student who unwittingly becomes involved in international espionage, now the most talked about scene in this movie is the dental torture scene in which Dustin Hoffman is tortured by Laurence Olivier. Olivier plays a Nazi doctor who uses his dentistry as a technique to extract information from people under torture. I want to just play this scene and then talk with you about making it. So this is Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, please don't worry. I'm not going into that cavity. That nerve's already dying. A live, freshly cut nerve is infinitely more sensitive.
So, I'll just drill into a healthy tooth until I reach the pulp. Unless, of course, you can tell me that it's safe.
Not very pretty, is it?
It's worse on sound than it is in vision, in fact.
No, it's more like the real thing where you have your eyes clenched shut and you're just hearing the sounds of the drill.
Yes, you never ever see it in the film. You never see drill on tooth. It's all suggested by eyes and by the drill coming towards the camera.
Well, civilians never really do see what that looks like. Only dentists get to see that.
No, but I mean, the audience never see it.
Right. But I mean, it's more like the way you experience
it. Yes, absolutely.
Because you don't see the drill hitting your teeth when you're in the dentist's office.
No, but you see it coming towards your mouth. And that scene, I mean, had everybody squirming. It was in the book, Bill Gohman's book, and I thought it was a terrific scene. But we had to do it very artfully. Though I knew that it was literally a nerve that would hit, when hit, would affect everyone, certainly me. Because I think very often you put things into films which affect you one way and another, certainly things that terrify you, and the dentist, going to the dentist, always terrified me. So it was a scene that I felt very, very strongly identification with.
Did you want to make the scene as horrible as possible, or did you want to keep it medium horrible?
I wanted to make it feel, but I didn't want it to be gloating over the violence of it, which is why we never showed anything graphic. It was all suggested. And the first moment that you hear the whir of the motor of the drill, you don't even see it. It's behind the lid of a suitcase, which is opened. I always think that everything is better suggested and leave the rest to the audience imagination, where possible.
It wouldn't surprise me if there was more than once when you were in the dentist chair and your dentist, before undoing the drill, gave you his impressions or her impressions of the scene. Has that happened to you?
Well, I must confess that since the film, I've been probably more scared of going to the dentist for fear that they'd get revenge. But I know my dentist quite well. And funnily enough, dentists that I've been to have always rather enjoyed the film. So they haven't tortured me too badly.
Well, good. Another film I want to ask you about, The Falcon and the Snowman, made in 1984. It starred Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn as Christopher Boyce and Andrew Lee. Was that the other person's name?
Dalton Lee.
And this is based on the true story of two young upper middle class men who sold secrets to the Soviets.
Yeah.
Very good performances in this. I want to play an excerpt of a scene where Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn are at the airport, and Penn has also been dealing drugs, and he's been getting high and hooked on his own drugs, and it's made him very paranoid, and he thinks that Timothy Hutton is going to turn on him and betray him.
Yes.
I'm not stupid, Chris. I read books.
What are you talking about?
I know
about
what it's called, disinformation, counter-espionage.
What?
You're backed by the company.
Oh, Jesus.
You're one of them. The CIA has got a picture of Oswald, and they've got one of me, too, and that's all part of the plan. So it's okay. It's okay. What happens next? You throw me in the wolves? You throw me in the wolves?
Look at that. It's doing to you.
It's the only thing keeping me safe.
It's killing you.
It's the only thing keeping me safe. I don't know who my friends are anymore. I don't know who to trust. I don't know who to trust. Don't throw me to the wolves.
Now, listen. You leave your bags behind. We're going to get on the plane and get out of here. We'll go home.
It's a very interesting performance from Sean Penn, yeah. In part because he's always seen as being an almost sex symbol, and in this movie he's such a flake.
Yeah.
He's so out of control and out of control of his mind
and such a fantasist. That's, again, it's the element of fantasy which attracted me to the character.
How did you tune up the performance with him and decide, even that whiny voice that he uses throughout so much of the movie?
Well, it happened, I think. It evolved during rehearsal. Both Timothy Hutton and, to a certain extent, Sean Penn, met the protagonists they were playing in jail. They visited them. Timothy Hutton had quite a long and close relationship, as close as it could ever get, over the telephone and occasional visits with Chris Boyce himself.
Chris Boyce was the real spy that this is based on.
Yes. And
did you approve of that? Of them going to jail and visiting?
I let them do it. I couldn't stand in their way. The only thing that there is always a problem about, reenacting a real person that exists, because there's always other bits of information you get which the actor playing the part thinks is vital. Oh, my goodness, that happened. We must show that. We must show this. And that can complicate, a screenplay which is fairly tight. And there were times when we had to alter things, or felt it right to alter things, from information that we'd got from the real people in life through the actors. But I thought that scene you've just played was going to be one of the most difficult to shoot, and it didn't turn out to be. I think that Sean Penn had prepared for it very well and knew what the high was like, had experienced it before, and played it. We did very few takes. We shot it in the airport at Mexico City, and I thought we would have to sort of gear up to it many times and would want to build a set in the studio, but we couldn't afford to do that, so we went out to do it on location in the airport, and it actually worked terribly well and very quickly.
That's a very good scene. You entered the film industry in England right after the Second World War. What kind of state was the movie industry in when you...
Well, I tried to get into it after the Second World War. I made when I was a student, a sort of amateur student film about a hanging in the 17th century that had actually taken place on a hill near where my family lived. And it got some attention. It was just a student film. And years then I became a professional actor, so I didn't go into the film industry immediately because, as usual, there was a slump, as there always seemed to be permanently slumps in different countries' film industry, and there certainly is often in England. And I tried, having made this student film, to get a job as a tea boy or an assistant, and couldn't. So I became a professional actor for some years, made a small documentary about Hyde Park, which got shown by BBC Television, and eventually got in through television, making small documentaries for magazine programmes. And that got me my break, finally.
What about working with actors? Do you have a certain style in working with them? Do you like to let them bring what they want to a performance, or do you try to pretty strictly guide what they do?
Well, I have very strong visual images of what I want to do with the film before I start shooting. And within those parameters, I feel that the actors must be given freedom to express themselves as much as they can. I mean, I think they've got a great deal to add to a film. If I respect the actors, there are some actors that are very selfish and need hitting hard, and some that are very inexperienced and frightened and need help. But the majority of them, I've found, are people that you're collaborating with in a spirit of very sort of warm creation, in a sense. You've got to give them space to feel free, to make fools of themselves if necessary, and then you are there to hold them down and to tell them where to taper down a performance. Because acting for the movies isn't really acting, it's being a character. And as long as I feel I'm trusted and I trust them, then I think there's an extremely fruitful atmosphere for collaboration.
Do you think that having acted before you started directing has made you more sensitive to the actors that you work with?
I think I know what their problems are when they come on the set and everybody's hanging around and there's pressure, which there always is, to get a performance as quickly as possible. And I admire good screen acting tremendously. I mean, there are certain favourite actors I have who, like Peter Finch had and Alan Bates has, which is the quality of conceal. There's more there, and it doesn't all show itself at once. Some actors, you see the performance, and they can be very good actors and very good performances, but you don't feel there's a reserve, greater emotional reserve underneath, which the best screen actors, I think, have. Monty Clift had it in spades.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your directing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Schlesinger has been my guest. His new film, Madame Szaszka, opens October 14th. It stars Shirley MacLaine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor Tom Hanks. He plays a brilliant but desperate stand-up comic in the new film Punchline. I hope you can join us. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's said only the Bible and the works of Shakespeare have been more widely distributed than the writings of Dr. Benjamin Spock. Coming up, Dr. Spock reflects on the advice he's given parents over the years and the way his own mother brought him up. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two albums by flutist James Galway. He describes one as splendid and the other as crass commercialism. And critic Ken Tucker reviews a new home video release. It's Quartet, four stories by William Somerset Maugham. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. National attention on tonight's vice presidential debate in Omaha sharpened today with the release of a CBS New York Times poll showing Michael Dukakis gaining ground on George Bush. The poll shows that skepticism about Dan Quayle's fitness for the number two spot is working in Dukakis's favor. Quayle and Lloyd Benson will face a national broadcast audience predicted to be in the millions. George Bush held a rally in Denver today before heading to Fort Worth, Texas. That's where he'll watch tonight's vice presidential debate. NPR's Jim Angle has details.
The vice president received an ecstatic welcome from the students of Arapahoe High School today, and he used the opportunity to talk about the need to do more for children. Though he provided few details in his speech, the campaign released a lengthy statement of problems facing young people and mothers, and the vice president pledged to address these matters if elected.
Because I feel that they are our greatest national resource, and I intend to use public funds where it's appropriate and well spent, but I also recognize that government cannot do for a local community what it must do for itself.
The proposals deal with far more than the classroom, including tighter enforcement of child support, tax breaks for adoption, and a $1 billion expansion of Head Start. On health care issues, he plans to step up efforts to deal with the problems of lead, radon, and asbestos at home and in schools, and to expand Medicaid coverage for poor families with children. Campaign officials say the cost of the new programs is about $700 million in the first year. The states would also have an increased burden, but the campaign could provide no estimate of how much. I'm Jim Angle with the Bush campaign in Denver, Colorado.
The Senate Judiciary Committee approved 11 nominees to the federal bench today, but left 14 others dangling. One of those still awaiting approval is President Reagan's choice to replace Robert Bork on the U.S. Court of Appeals. After months of delay, the committee quickly approved 9 of the judges by voice vote and cleared 2 others with little discussion. The 2 appeals court judges and 9 district judges cleared by the committee still must be approved by the full Senate in the final days of the 100th Congress. In Chile, voter turnout was heavy today in the referendum on the 15-year military rule of General Augusto Pinochet. This, despite explosions that downed power lines overnight, briefly blacking out Santiago and central Chile. Pinochet called the plebiscite, which offered Chileans a vote, that's a yes or no ballot. A majority of yes votes would allow Pinochet to resume, assume, an 8-year presidential term. But if no votes prevail, Pinochet would be replaced in March 1990 by the winner of multi-party elections. Iraq's foreign minister left New York today after one day of peace talks with his Iranian counterpart. Negotiations are scheduled to resume in Geneva on a date to be set by UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. According to the BBC's Barnaby Mason, the peace talks appear to be in an impasse.
No breakthrough, no breakdown. That's how the UN Secretary General, Mr. Perez de Cuellar, put it after last Saturday's unproductive session. But the chronic suspicion and hostility between Iraq and Iran seem, if anything, to have been intensified over the past few days. The Iranian foreign minister, Mr. Ali Akbar Velayati, told the General Assembly that Iraq was trying to achieve from the talks illegitimate political and military objectives that it had failed to gain in the war. Mr. Aziz responded by accusing Iran of engaging in blackmail and maneuvering. He denied that Iraq had imposed preconditions in the talks. All we want, he said, is freedom of navigation in international waters in the Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, and the clearing by the UN of the Shatt al-Arab waterway, virtually the only outlet Iraq has to the sea. In other words, the talks are stuck where they have been from the beginning.
Barnaby Mason in Cairo. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 2106.51. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Flute superstar James Galway has two new albums, one a greatest hits collection, and the other a recording of flute concertos by the almost forgotten 19th century Italian composer Saverio Mercadante. Lloyd says Galway makes Mercadante's concertos sound very much like vocal music.
Saverio Mercadante is a name out of the music history textbooks. He wrote over 60 operas in his 75 years and was for a while a leading innovator in opera reform. He had an important influence on Verdi, especially in the way he brought to opera orchestration some of the harmonic subtlety of purely orchestral composition. He also wrote orchestral music. He studied flute and violin at the Conservatory of Naples, of which he later became director. The three flute concertos on James Galway's new album, written in the late 18-teens, are the first pieces by Mercadante I can ever remember hearing. They are satisfying, elegant, though certainly not profound works. Each has a rather large-scale, formal opening movement that contains the most serious but least interesting music in the scores, sort of a poor cousin to early Beethoven. Things pick up in the middle movements by slowing down. Here's where Mercadante becomes the true contemporary of Rossini, Donizetti, and Bellini. These brief, sweetly melancholy andantes and largos sound like the bel canto arias of these early 19th century masters of Italian opera, and they give our soloist his long-awaited chance to sing. Remember how important flutes are in operatic mad scenes. I also like the finales. Two of them are Polish movements marked Polacca Brillante, and one is Russian, Rondo Russo. These playful, exotic movements give the concertos the lift they need, the color and rhythmic variety. Thank you. The performances by Galway, the man with the golden flute, are splendid in every way, as you can probably tell. Long-breathed and liquid, beautifully phrased for the melody, glistening in timbre, and with a quality that's too often lacking in Galway's more popular crossover playing, modesty, even when the music is at its showiest. The concertos were recorded in the Duomo Vecchio, the old church in Monselice, Italy, near Venice, and the sound itself has a vibrant, airy presence. The orchestra, the Soloisti Veneti, is expertly conducted by Claudio Scimone, who is credited with revising the score from Mercadante's original autographs. RCA has also just issued an album of James Galway's greatest hits, which I found demoralizing in its crass commercialism. The Saber Dance doesn't work in a 2.5-minute flute arrangement, even with the Royal Philharmonic accompanying, though I suppose it's better than any arrangement of Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue. A haunting Christmas Carol version of Greensleeves is undermined by a soft rock, soft core, airport Muzak version of the Pachelbel Canon, co-arranged by Galway himself, that's nauseating in its musical insensitivity. At least the Mercadante album suggests that Galway is still looking for good out-of-the-way material, that he hasn't completely sold out, even though it sometimes sounds like he has.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed two new RCA albums featuring flutist James Galway, one a greatest hits collection, and the other the flute concertos of Saverio Mercadante. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Benjamin Spock's book on baby and child care begins with the sentence, "You know more than you think you do." But after that reassuring start, he offers nervous parents plenty of advice about their child's health and development. Since the mid-40s, Spock's book has been considered the Bible of baby care. In the late 60s, the famous baby doctor was also in the front lines of anti-war protests. At the age of 85, Spock is still writing. His new book is called Dr. Spock on Parenting. I asked Dr. Spock how his views on raising children have changed over the years.
I always believe that parents should respect their children but should not forget to ask for respect from their children. And I never changed my basic philosophy, though of course all kinds of things have changed in pediatrics and there have been all kinds of sociological changes. I don't mean that I'm obstinate, stuck in the mud. Maybe I am, but I wouldn't be proud of that.
You combined pediatrics and psychology. And I was wondering what brought the realization to you that the two in your work belong together.
There were no other pediatricians who'd had formal training in psychoanalysis or psychiatry or psychology. I was in the middle of my pediatric residency when I realized I must have some kind of training, and I wrote to several professors of pediatrics asking where I could get such training, and they all answered there is no such training, which certainly was true. So I thought in terms of a residency. I took a one-year residency in psychiatry that was going to include some child psychiatry. The one thing that I learned out of that year was that the people on the staff, the teaching staff, who made the patient's symptoms and behavior meaningful were the psychoanalytically trained people. So I decided I need psychoanalytic training. So in 1933, when I started pediatric practice, I began psychoanalytic training at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. If you want to persist, why did I decide that this was so important? I think that it was because I grew up in a very child-centered family. My mother stopped playing bridge that she loved to do when I was born and kept away from the bridge table until our youngest child was in college. But she was also a very severe parent who made life somewhat miserable for all of her children. And I think my feeling was, one, I'm concerned about being the best kind of pediatrician I can be, but I must have also realized, at least dimly, there are pleasanter, easier ways of bringing up children than the rather severe, stern, moralistic way my mother brought all of us up.
When you first started publishing your child, your baby and child care book, it was, I think, 1946.
That's right.
What kind of advice was in the air then? What were the typical baby care manuals telling parents to do?
Well, a good example would be thumb-sucking. The books that predated mine said thumb-sucking is a bad habit. And if you see your baby beginning to thumb suck, why, you should immediately step in and prevent it by, one, painting nasty-tasting stuff on the thumb, or another way is to put aluminum mitts on the baby's hands, or the most horrible way is to spread eagle the baby by tying his wrists to the slats of the side of his crib. And when I was a resident in pediatrics, nurses thought that they were doing their duty. Here were these poor, miserable infants snatched away from home and from everybody that they knew, and they were trying to comfort themselves, at least half of them, by sucking their thumbs, and they weren't allowed to do even that. Well, I couldn't find out right away what's good advice about thumb sucking, but gradually I came to the kind of advice that's in baby and child care, that it has something to do with not having enough sucking satisfaction.
So what do you tell parents to do if their baby is sucking?
I say, don't wait until he becomes a thumb sucker. And incidentally, some babies have the skill to be a thumb sucker right from birth, and others it takes them a couple of months to learn regularly to get the thumb in their mouth. What I say is, just as soon as you see signs that the baby is trying, use a pacifier.
Since 1968, some people have charged you with permissiveness.
I know.
And because of some of the principles in the baby and child care book, but also by 1968, you were in the front lines of the anti-war protests. And I think some people felt that the baby boom generation that was demonstrating against the war was somehow under your spell.
I know.
Because of your baby and child care books. Did you think that the permissiveness charges really had as much to do with anti-war protests as it did with parenting?
I think that the accusations that I was permissive came not from anything that was in my book. It really came from the political situation that I was opposed to a war that a majority, certainly of conservative people, felt should be supported. Actually, it's always people who've not used the book who are sure that my book was corruptive. The kind of letter that I used to get, angry letter that I only get rarely now, said, "Thank God I never used your horrible book. That's why my children take baths and wear clean clothes and get good grades in school." Whereas the people who've used my book almost invariably say, if they mention this subject at all, they say, "And I don't see that the book is permissive." And I say, "That's right. Never was intended to be permissive. I never believed that you should give children anything they want or let them say anything they want or have anything they want."
When you started protesting against the war in Vietnam and marching against it, you were already in your 60s.
That's right.
And you once said,
strange age to begin behaving like that.
Well, usually people get more conservative, not more radical as they get older.
Right.
But you once said that when you first started demonstrating, you found the experience excruciatingly embarrassing.
Oh, it was.
Well,
I was
why?
A very self-conscious person to be out on picketing and walking around in a circle and having television and radio people stick a microphone under my nose and say, "Doctor, what are you doing here?" As if I'd been caught in a raid. It was very embarrassing to me. I counted on my dignity. I didn't start by protesting against the war in Vietnam. You see, what I started with was the need for a test ban treaty back mm-hmm. in 1962. I was convinced that if we didn't have a test ban treaty and all nations as they developed nuclear arms kept testing to their heart's content, there'd be more and more fallout all around the world, more and more children dying of cancer and leukemia or being born with mental and physical defects. So I saw it very definitely as a pediatric issue.
In your baby and child care book, you have a warning to your readers. You write, "Warning, salesmen for children's encyclopedias, sets of books on child care, nursery furniture, children's clothing and equipment may claim that Dr. Spock is intimately connected with their enterprises in some way, or at least endorse their products. All such claims are fraudulent and entitle you to threaten to call the authorities." In order to get rid of the salesman. Has Dr. Spock become such the institution that you have to issue warnings to your readers to watch out for this?
I don't know whether the warnings are necessary now. Certainly for a while I found from parents reporting to me that salesmen came around were very persistent. So I wanted to give parents a good, strong basis for turning them away, to tell them, "You're a scoundrel and get out of my way before I call the police."
That's good. One last question. What did you ever show your mother your baby and child care book? And if so, what was her reaction to it?
Well, I was living in fear and trembling when the book came out about what my mother would say, because it ran very counter to many of her ideas. And after I'd sent her a copy, I was almost trembling, waiting for her to say something. And she said, "Benny, I think it's quite sensible." Well, I don't know whether she really read it or whether she really read it but didn't understand what was in it, or whether she was just decided to be kind. Anyway, it was a great relief.
Dr. Spock, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been fun.
Dr. Benjamin Spock's new book is called Dr. Spock on Parenting. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How are you preparing us for tonight's debate?
Well, we should be hearing from our political correspondent, Linda Wertheimer, and we'll also be presenting an analysis of what is the essence of the sidekick. The sidekick in literature and show business, we think that's appropriate on the day of the vice presidential debate.
Are you following up on Election Day in Chile?
We are. This is the day of the plebiscite on Pinochet's military regime, and we'll have a report from Tom Jelton. You may have heard on yesterday's program reports about Chileans preparing for the vote. They prepare by buying necessities, food, and batteries. They fear there might be some unrest. Today we begin to get the actual results.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. William Somerset Maugham was a prodigious writer. His selected works are contained in no less than 35 volumes. In 1948, when he'd already written over 100 short stories and scores of novels and plays, four of the British author's short stories were adapted for the screen. The film was called Quartet. It's now available on home video. Critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Quartet is one of the most entertaining anthology films ever made. Its four stories are certainly diverse ones, but they obviously share the sensibility of their author, William Somerset Maugham. At the time of the film's release, Maugham had moved beyond his early classy cult status to become a hugely popular best-selling author. At the same time, his standing in the literary world had begun to slip. Critics were accusing him of coasting, of writing little more than well-crafted soap operas. In a fascinating touch, Maugham himself introduces Quartet and uses the opportunity to address his critics.
Fact and fiction are so intermingled in my work that now, looking back, I can hardly distinguish one from the other. In my 20s, The critics said I was brutal. In my 30s, they said I was flippant. In my 40s, they said I was cynical. In my 50s, they said I was competent. And then in my 60s, they said I was superficial. I went my own way with a shrug of the shoulders, following the path I had traced and trying with my work to fill out the pattern of life that I had made for myself.
As for the stories themselves, they're entertaining little anecdotes, stories whose sentiments might best be described as Graham Greene crossed with O. Henry. In the first and best of them, a story called The Facts of Life, a young tennis player is about to embark on a tournament to be held in Paris. Before he leaves, his stuffy father gives him some advice.
Well, I don't want to play the heavy father, but this is the first time you've been abroad on your own, and I wouldn't like you to get in a mess.
Well, don't worry, I won't.
No, that's right. Now, look, Nicky, when I was your age, my father gave me 3 bits of advice, and I've lived up to them ever since, and I hope you will. The first is gambling. Don't gamble, whatever anybody else may do. The second is money. Don't lend money, not in any circumstances. And the third is women. Don't have anything to do with women. Now then, if you lay off those 3 things, you won't go far wrong, so be a good boy and try and remember.
No, I did. I won't forget, I promise.
That's right.
Gee, guess what 3 things the son becomes involved in? He gambles, he lends money, and he romances a French woman who gazes at him on the tennis court and says, "Ooh, you look so good in your tennis shorts." Each story in Quartet was overseen by a different director, no big names, and the stars aren't exactly luminous. The best known is probably Dirk Bogarde, who plays a callow playboy pianist in an adaptation of The Alien Corn. But taken together, the stories in Quartet take you back to a time when Maugham's rather overwrought realism represented the height of dramatic frankness. Seen today, Quartet seems almost romantic in its universe of civility and privilege. Other new video cassette releases include Broadcast News, the zippy, satirical look at TV news, starring William Hurt, Holly Hunter, and Albert Brooks. James L. Brooks wrote it and directed it, and the dialogue has a snap that recalls an earlier era in filmmaking. There's also Frantic, director Roman Polanski's rather awkward attempt at a Hitchcock-style thriller. It stars Harrison Ford as an American doctor in Paris. He's attending a medical convention, his wife gets kidnapped, there's something about a complicated spy plot, you know, the usual sort of thing. Among older movies, your best bet is Roman Holiday, the 1953 romantic comedy directed by William Wyler. It stars Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck. Hepburn plays a teenage princess who runs away to Rome. Gregory Peck is the impeccable reporter who chaperones her. Never has a career in journalism looked so rewarding.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. In the late 1960s, Twiggy was probably the world's best-known fashion model. She was almost certainly the skinniest. Since leaving modeling at the age of 19, she's become a respected stage and screen actress. She co-stars in the new film Madame Suzatska. On the next Fresh Air, Twiggy talks about making the transition from modeling to acting. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Land of Dreams, the new album from singer-songwriter Randy Newman. And humorist Alice Kahn plays out her fantasy of being a singer. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.